All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Wow. And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. It's kind of a quick changeover we had to do today. I'm getting running a little bit behind already. Welcome to Veterans Radio. We're really excited to have you here. We're going to be talking all about Navy Seabees today. We've got one in the studio, and we've got one out in New Jersey, and we've got other ones that are all over the place. So we want to make sure that you stay tuned and listen to these stories of these incredible construction workers. They build, they fight, they do everything that they need, and that's what happens with the Navy Seabees. So we're excited to do that. You can listen to Veterans Radio, and you obviously are, here at WAAM here in Ann Arbor, or you can hear us on our website. That's veteransradio.net. Click on Listen Live, and you can hear it all over the country. The other thing you can find on our website, of course, are our podcasts of a lot of different stories that we've done. We've kind of edited them down so that you can listen to them there if you want to. You can also find out our archived programs. I think they go back 3 or 4 years. Remember, Veterans Radio is really excited and very proud to be on the air now going on 13 years. We got at least another 13 to go. And so we're pretty excited about that. And we want to make sure that you are listening to us and following us. And as Jim Falzone, one of our partners, said, you know, you can always follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and all the other things. I don't even know what they're called. So you can keep track of us there, and you can contact us. If you want to get in on the action today and give us a call here at Veterans Radio, you can do that at 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. And we'll take your call on the air, and you might have some questions about our guests or about a CB, or maybe you are a CB. And so we welcome your participation in the program. First of all, I've got a couple of events that are coming up that I want to make sure that we get to. Number one is next weekend, and locally, this is called Music Fest for Vets. And this is August 13th and 14th at the VFW Post 9885 in Westland, Michigan. It's on Hicks Road, and it is it's for the Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund and Disabled American Veterans, Veterans Haven Outreach Center. $10 entry to get in there for both days, and it goes from noon till whenever. Is that what it says there? Whenever? No, 10 p.m. both days. Professional sound, music, live music, recorded music, annual music festival in Metro Detroit. For more information, you can go to musicfestforvets.org. That's musicfest4vets.org. Music Fest for Vets. Next weekend, August 13th and 14th at VFW Post 9885 in Westland, Michigan. It's on Hicks Road. Pretty cool. Might have something to do next weekend. So make sure you go. Again, this is to benefit the Fallen and Wounded Warriors Fund, Disabled American Veterans, and Veterans Haven Outreach Center. All great organizations, all really trying to do what they can to help America's veterans. The other thing going on in 2 weeks, all right, this is, okay, all you rotorheads out there, you know who you are. This is for Thunder Over Michigan that's coming again to Willow Run, to the Yankee Air Museum in Willow Run, Michigan. And this is a Thunder Over Michigan air show, and let me give you just an idea of who's going to be there. This is coming up on the 20th and 21st of August. I don't know if you like airplanes. If you really like airplanes, this is the place where you've got to be. So, for instance, they have a lot of static displays out there. So you get, there's a B-52 out there. There are Hueys. There are all kinds of jets. There's biplanes. There's every plane that you can possibly imagine, pretty much. They've got a simulator that you can pretend that you are actually flying. And, you know, in this world of artificial intelligence, they're so realistic. I crashed 3 times last week when I was on there. Kind of like when I was in flight school and I flew off the edge of the world. But anyway, so this is a great opportunity for you to go there to the Thunder Over Michigan, August 20th and 21st. There's the Air Force F-22 Raptor. A demonstration is going to be there. The Navy's F-18 Super Hornet. The North American F-100 Super Saber is there. The Breitling Jet Era Precision Jet Team is going to be there. You know, anyway, you won't believe what these people can do. And there's an organization called Hilo Town USA. This is what I was talking to about you, to you rotorheads. pretty much every type of helicopter that you could imagine is going to be there, from the OH-13 all the way up to the Cobras, the Hueys, the Russian helicopters, the Loaches, everything that you can think of. So that's going to be kind of interesting, I think, to see there. And that's going to be on both days as a static demonstration, and as also they'll be flying around there. And also the Batcopter and the Batmobile are going to be there, which is really an OH-13. But anyway, we won't mention that. And the Coast Guard's HH-65 Dolphin demo will be there, and there's going to be World War II battle demonstrations and reenactments. So this is all these activities are going on at the Yankee Air Museum. For more information, you can go on their website, which is yankeeairmuseum.org. That's yankeeairmuseum.org. Click on the air show, and this is always fun, folks. This is a great opportunity for you to see what American aviation is really all about, past and present and future sometimes. So make sure you're out there on the 20th and 21st. I got another organization that I want to talk about today. And this one is one that I got an email about, and it's kind of cool. So I want to bring on our guest right now, and this is from an organization called CatchALiftFund.com, and her name is Lynn Coughlin. And Lynn, she's not on the phone yet. Okay, we aren't able to find her, right? Okay, well, Lynn, if you are listening, give us a call. Hold on, maybe I better check my phone. Sometimes people call me on the cell phone by mistake. So, nope, she didn't call me there either. Well, let me give you a little background on this organization, if I can, because she was supposed to do that. Catch a Lift Fund, what it does is it provides gym memberships for veterans. And the organization was a result of her brother, who unfortunately was killed in Afghanistan in 2009. And I have to find all these things now. Hold on just a second here. Okay, it's the Christopher Coughlin Memorial Fund, and they're doing business as Catch a Lift Fund. And what the organization does, as I mentioned before, is it's based in Maryland, but it helps veterans out all over the country by purchasing memberships to gymnasiums like LA Fitness. I don't know, probably all the other ones that are out there that have famous names that I can't recall off the top of my head now. But it's a great organization, and they really do help, and they've got a lot of people that have responded to, we're going to continue trying to get a hold of Lynn. But the Catch a Lift provides individualized fitness programs and gym memberships and in-home exercise equipment to veterans throughout the nation. It also offers peer support to each member through small squads of veterans. Currently, more than 22 wounded veterans are in the program. And if you'd like to get some assistance, get out there and exercise. Sometimes it maybe, helps you feel a little bit better. And I think that you'll want to contact the organization, as I said, which is catchalift.com. Check it out and let us know how it goes, because some of these things are really nice things. It says that Cal, Catch a Lift has helped me in tremendous ways. ESPT, PTSD, TBI, and Cal was able to help me get back into the gym and get to work again. And that's all we need sometimes. People that suffer from traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress is just somebody, something, somehow get them to get up and start moving again. And you never know what it's going to be. So check this organization out. I think you'll find it might be interesting. It's called catchalift.com. So next coming up is we're going to be talking with some Navy CBs. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to our CBs, and we'll introduce them when you get here. So you're listening to Veterans Radio, and we'll be right back after this. And we are back on Veterans Radio, and today is a Navy Day, and I forgot at the beginning of the program to say happy birthday to the Coast Guard. Yeah, what was I thinking? My dad was in the Coast Guard. So happy birthday to the United States Coast Guard, 226 years old. Whew, it's almost as old as my dad would be. So happy birthday to them. Now we're getting back to the Navy. All right, United States Navy has a bunch of different divisions, and I don't know anything about the Navy since I wasn't in the Navy, and I can't, you know, they don't have platoons, they don't have battalions, and well, they have battalions, but they don't have companies and all that other weird stuff that we do in the Army, so I'm not familiar with it. But joining me in the studio right now is a Vietnam-era vet and CB, and that is Larry San Antoine. And Larry, welcome to Veterans Radio.
It was my pleasure being here.
Okay, and joining me on the line is another and a friend of Larry's, and a fellow New Jerseyite, and that is Bill Weber. Bill, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much.
So tell me, I'm going to start with Larry here. Tell me a little bit about the Seabees. What are the Seabees, and where did they come from?
Well, basically, that's most of the question we get when we walk around wearing a Navy Seabee hat. People ask us, what is a Seabee? I even had a little old lady that was really impressed that I was in the Navy SEALs. Of course, she didn't hit the B part on the CB, so it was a good mistake. But CBs, originally, before World War II started, the Navy used civilian contractors to do all their work, maintenance on the docks, building docks, you know, stevedores, civilian stevedores. When World War II started, they realized that they couldn't arm these civilians because if they were ever captured, they'd be executed automatically. So the Navy decided to build these naval battalions. And we do have battalions, we do have companies, and we do have squads and fire teams. So actually kind of started out as a branch of the Marines.
Of the Marines, okay.
Yeah, because the Navies were under the Marine jurisdiction back then. And so we trained with the Marines. We went out as battalions. In World War II, there were 325,000 Seabees in World War II. They covered over 300 islands, built over 111 airstrips. And so, you know, building airstrips, storage facilities, docks, stevedore docks where they unloaded it for the Marines. And then they also served in Europe, but mostly in the Pacific.
Okay, so my understanding of this, and Bill, feel free to jump in. Do you want to add anything to what Larry said?
Oh, so far, so good.
So far, so good. All right. Yeah, it's from what I was reading, and I am not an expert at this at all, so but I'll just kind of jump in here, was that they decided that they figure out that the Pacific was going to be this island-hopping routine right from the beginning. And that they needed people that were going to be able to build these things. And as you mentioned, they couldn't use civilian contractors because if they got captured and so on and so forth, they couldn't issue weapons to them. Although I guess today maybe they can. I don't know. but that they set up these construction battalions. And you guys in World War II, you know, they went in on the landings with them, right along with them, with the weapons and everything else. Because I was reading a story about Iwo Jima and about a memorial that they had, that the Seabees had actually built up on top of Mount Suribachi to the guys that had been there. So when you talk about your motto being that you fight and you build, you know, and can do, which is, you know, our former partner Gary Lilly was a Navy CB too, and that's what he lived on, that phrase every day, you know, if you just can do, just do it. Don't even think about it. So not only were you building runways and building hooches and living facilities and sanitation material issues and so on and so forth, right?
Yes.
So you you went in on all these major landings during World War II, not you specifically.
The original UDT, the most of them were Seabees because a lot of the divers, when they made the call for the Seabees, they were looking for construction people that already had were already in the construction field. And a lot of them were already divers, hard hat divers and regular divers. So when they started the UDT, they were taking...
What was UDT?
Underwater Demolition Team. That would be your Navy SEALs eventually. They used Seabees, they used some Marines, they used some special forces of the Army and things like that. And they would go in ahead of time and, you know, clear out. But they would also be, you know, once the Marines hit the shore and got advanced enough, the Seabees would start building the docks to supply them.
Mm-hmm.
And so their job was to supply the ammunition, whatever they needed up front as they were going forward. And as soon as they cleared the spaces, then they had to start building the airstrips. Like you said, the 111 airstrips they built.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, because in many of the stories that we've been talking about here on Veterans Radio over the years have had CBs in the background somewhere along the line. And if you, Bill, if you're listening to the program on the internet, you might want to turn down your volume because we're getting a little feedback from you.
Okay.
Okay. And if you're on speakerphone, you might want to take it off speakerphone because we're picking up somebody that's really happy in the background whistling.
Someone whistling.
Anyway, all right. So the average age, though, of these CBs during World War II was pretty old.
37.
Okay.
And there were 40s and 50s. It depended how long they'd been in the construction trade and what rating they would get or what rank they would be as they came in. The majority of them came in as E4s, which would be a third-class petty officer.
Okay.
So
third-class petty officer. E4 is like a, what is that, a sergeant? Bucks?
No. Corporal. No.
Corporal.
Corporal, yeah.
Thanks, Bill. I can't keep track of all these E stuff.
And, of course, after World War II, because there was 27 battalions, they started decommissioning.
How big is a battalion, approximately?
1,000, around 1,000. You have four companies in there. You have Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, and Delta. And example, Alpha was mechanics and equipment operators. Bravo was plumbers and electricians and so on, steel workers and stuff like that. And then we were broke up into platoons and fire teams and stuff like that. But they started decommissioning after World War II. Obviously, you don't need that many battalions and stuff like that until about 1951. And then they recommissioned several of the battalions with Korea coming on, you know, in the words. So there were like 10,000 CBs served in Korea. They were at the Incheon? Is that what it?
Incheon.
At the assault. The CBs took part in that. And there, through that time, they did the same thing they did in World War II. They built airstrips. They built camps. And also, the whole time, they've improved the infrastructure of the country they were in, building new roads, building bridges, and things like that. So they were kind of getting ready when they recommissioned in 1951. Matter of fact, Bill and I battalion was recommissioned in 1951, MCB4. And so, you know, 10,000 fought in Korea. And then, of course, then we got peacetime again, you know.
And then we come back. Let's move on to the next one, which happens to be Vietnam.
Yes.
We're talking with two Navy CBs here. We're talking with Larry San Antoine and Bill Weber, who were Vietnam veterans, CBs there, and so we're going to kind of get into that time period right now. But if you have a question or a comment and you'd like to get in on the conversation, please give us a call, 734-822-1600, 734-822-1600. So which one of you guys went into service first? Bill?
Well, I don't know when Larry went in. I went in on June 15th. 1966.
I was in 64, but I was in high school.
High school?
I joined when I was in high school in September of 1964.
September of 1960. Oh, I was a college freshman then.
Yeah, I joined the reserves. At that time in Detroit at Broadhead Naval Army, they had a CB reserve unit there. When the units were decommissioned, a lot of them became reserve units in different states.
Okay.
So RMCB 26 was in downtown Detroit. So I decided, because I worked construction since I was 8 years old, I talked my dad into signing for me while I was in junior in high school.
Oh, okay. And Bill, you enlisted in New Jersey?
Yes, I did.
Had you gotten a draft notice, or did you just do this?
Actually, I did. I got a draft notice, and just by a fortune of coincidence, I was told by my foreman on a job where I was working that the Navy was looking for construction people, and if you signed up, you would get an advanced rate. So I took advantage of the program. It was called the Indirect Petty Officer Input Program, and the nickname for it was Instant Petty Officer, or IPO.
I this guy. I think the Army had something like that too for pilots. So you enlisted into the Seabees. Where did you do your basic?
Directly into the Seabees, yes.
Where did you do your basic training? Or did you do basic training?
We trained in Davisville, Rhode Island.
Okay. And Larry, where did you?
Construction Battalion Center.
Okay.
I went to Great Lakes, Illinois, in between my junior and senior year in high school.
Okay. Yeah, you were telling me earlier that you didn't get to graduate with your class because you had to go back to school.
Yeah, I had the day they were supposed to graduate at Great Lakes, I was entering the high school in Detroit. So.
But all right. So we've got you guys into the CB. What, Bill? What was your training like? What did they teach you that you didn't know?
Naval history, basically, it's what they taught us. They didn't teach us anything about construction because we were already trained and supposedly skilled in it.
Okay. So was the basic training like other basic trainings where, you, as you said, you learned Navy history, discipline, rules and regulations, and a lot of exercise?
Basically, that's it.
Okay.
Just like all the other basic trainings.
Okay.
Just modified a little bit.
So
we didn't learn too much about ships or what to do at sea.
Okay. Well, you guys, did you ever go on ships?
No. Basically, the battalions went over as battalions. Unlike the other services, we went over all 1,000 to 1,200 men with our equipment.
Oh, okay.
We did 9-month tours and then 3 months back at the States.
Okay.
Interesting story. One of the reasons I joined is the recruiter told me I'd spend 9 months in Hollylock, Scotland 1 year, and then 9 months in Rota, Spain the next year, and then the rest of the time was back in the States. But unfortunately, in 65, Vietnam came around.
Yeah, so. I didn't get to do a whole lot of world traveling either.
No.
all right. So both of you complete your training and... did you both go to Vietnam at the same time, or Bill, when did you go to Vietnam?
We went in January of 1967. Our flights left from California.
Okay. And where did you end up in Vietnam?
We ended up in Da Nang, Vietnam.
Okay. And Larry, when did you arrive?
I went through Class A school because I didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't a IPO. So I was already an E3 when I went active duty from the reserves. So I went to Class A school at Port Hueneme, California. And then I shipped, Bill was already over there, and I shipped, I flew over Trans Am or whatever, into Da Nang to join the battalion, around, it wasn't too long after they got there. Cause Bill and I got together in, it was end of May, wasn't it, Bill? When we went up to Khe Sanh?
Yeah, we got the Khe Sanh June 1st. We landed in Khe Sanh.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so that's when we were in the same camp. We were in the same company. I think we were in different hooches, so where we lived. Mm-hmm. But it ended up that they asked for 3 volunteers to go up to Khe Sanh, and Bill and a fellow named Phil Menahan and I, myself, volunteered to go up there to do some work on their water treatment system and lay some pipeline.
Okay. Well, before we go up to Khe Sanh, we got about a little over 2 minutes or so before we have to take a break at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Veterans Radio, and we're talking with two Navy Seabees here. We're talking with Larry San Antoine and Bill Weber, who arrived in Vietnam in 1967. What did you do? What was your first job when you first got there? Bill, I'll go with you since you got there earlier.
Okay, the first job that I can remember, you know, being a plumber, first job that we were assigned was a stockade fence. It was a cyclone fence around the 3rd Marine Brig.
Oh, okay. Well, they welcomed you for that.
Yeah. So I used all my piping experience doing fence posts.
All right. Larry, what was your first job when you got there? You got there in May, right?
January, February, about March,
okay.
Early March. Well, I flew over, and when you're Navy, you fly in dress wool blues. And I got off the plane at Da Nang Air Base. It was 120 degrees. And so I got a ride to the camp. And when I went to the company commander, he put me to work that day putting toilets in and piping in for one of the officers' mess. But I didn't have a chance of drawing a uniform, so I had to do it in my dress blues. And I think I lost about 10 pounds that day. So.
Well, the officers always had to have the finest.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. You know, and I can remember that running into to naval officers, even eating in naval dining rooms. I couldn't believe the food that the officers had. I don't know what the enlisted guys had, but they had white tablecloths and actual silverware. Different services are very different. It's very, very interesting to talk about that. We're going to take a break here in less than a minute, so I'm going to ask you guys to hold on here. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what happened when you went up even further north than where you were. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We're talking about Navy Seabees today. These are the construction guys. They fight, they build, they can do. This program today is dedicated to our former partner, Gary Lilly, who was a Navy CB. And so we want you to stick around because things are going to get more interesting as we get up into the caisson area. Most of you have heard of that have studied Vietnam at all. So remember the number here, 734-822-1600. We want your calls. We'll talk to you in just a little bit. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back. Back on Veterans Radio. Okay, guys, what was that song?
Where's the Seabees of the Navy?
There you go. It's a Seabees song. Yeah. Come on. It took me hours to find it.
they don't even know we have a flag. So
it says, we are the Seabees of the Navy. We can build and we can fight. We'll pave our way to victory and guard it day and night. We promise we'll remember the 7th of December. We're the Seabees of the Navy, bees of the seven seas. The Navy wanted men, that's where we came in, Mr. Brown and Mr. Jones, the Owens, the Cohens, and Flynn. The Navy wanted more of Uncle Sam's kin, so we all joined up and, brother, we're in to win. This says unofficial third verse, so I got to be careful with this one, maybe. We're the Seabees of the Navy, the can-do men in green. In war and peace, you'll find us ready on the scene. And no matter what our mission, we'll uphold our proud tradition. We're the Seabees of the Navy, bees of the seven seas. So there, you guys didn't know. You had your own song with words, too.
Oh, we knew. I knew it.
I couldn't find a version with the words sang. That was by, give them credit, Sam Lewis wrote the words and Pete DeRose wrote the music. I don't know if either one of them are still around or not. I kind of doubt it, but I thank them. So I think that's kind of cool. All right, so we're talking right now with Larry San Antoine and with Bill Weber, both Navy CBs from the Vietnam time, 1967. And for some reason, you know, one of the things that my father told me and probably many of our fathers told us when we joined the service was never volunteer for anything. So, Bill, I'm going to ask you first. What were you doing up in Quezon and how did you get there?
We flew in on a C-130. Like most of the transportation in Vietnam was helicopter. Mm-hmm. And the two times I went to Vietnam, I never flew in a helicopter, only fixed-wing aircraft.
I thought I gave everybody a ride when I was over there somewhere along the line. But this mission to Quezon, what was it about?
It was about water supply. We had to finish the water supply line from the reservoir down below at the river, and it was piped up the hill through the perimeter wire and up to the water point on the base.
Okay, and the important thing I want to get to is that you volunteered to go up here.
Well, more or less. You know how it is in the military.
Yes. We need three volunteers, you, and you, right? Larry, do you remember it quite that way?
It was close to that, yeah. I mean, we're on the base, you know, going out to job sites and stuff like that. And all your other guys are going out further out, and they're, you know, for a week or two at a time, or on stat teams, which went out for a month at a time to villages and things like that. So, you know, you're young, you're dumb, you're stupid, you're gung-ho, and you want to travel, and so...
off you go.
Off we went.
Oh, okay.
Like you said, don't volunteer.
So Billy, in case you're trying to provide water for them up there, can you describe what happened once you arrived at Quezon?
Yeah, we got there on June 1st. This was a few weeks after the hill fights. That's where the Marines received their new M16s, and they were having trouble with them. They were jamming and all kinds of problems.
Can you describe the area of Quezon? It was down in a valley, wasn't it?
It was
on top of a hill.
Quezon is located on a plateau.
Oh, okay.
In the middle of the mountain range. I don't know why they picked it for a base, because militarily, you don't want to have the low ground with the enemy looking down at you.
Yeah, that's what I meant. There were all these hilltops around.
Yeah.
That's around, kind of like Dien Bien Phu. Sound like, you know.
Right. We had Marines on most of the hills,
mm-hmm.
but the North Vietnamese were up there also. So it was patrols would go out and they would find them, and then they would disappear into their spider holes.
Okay.
But they told us when we went that it was a secure area. That's the point I'm trying to make. It was after the hill fights and before the siege.
Okay.
So they considered it a pacified area.
So how long were you there before you found out it wasn't quite so secure?
Actually, we were there for about 4 days.
Okay.
We started to believe them. And on the night of the fifth day, we went, we had cots. We were sleeping in tents and cots.
Mm-hmm.
We had, there was really no cover. We had the trenches alongside the tents in the case we came under attack. But it didn't help in our case because it was around 1 a.m. in the morning of June 6th, and rockets and mortars started to come in. The first one came in. I don't know where it landed, but it kind of woke everybody up. It didn't wake me up, though. The second one woke me up because it hit our tent, direct hit on our tent.
Wow.
I need to step in. The second one didn't wake him up. I woke him up.
Yeah, he
slept through it.
He had to come
even
in
though
and
it
wake
hit,
me up
it hit the
one.
Tent?
That was an air burst, wasn't it, Bill?
I think it was because it hit the tent and blew in
it hit
the air.
Someone said it hit the tent, the top of the tent post, and that's the only thing that saved most of us. But Bill got a shrapnel in his leg, and he slept through it. I had to wake him up.
And the only thing I remember was it was very hot, and all I could see was like red through my eyes, I guess. And through my eyelids, I could actually see the light was so bright when the explosion went off.
Yeah. To me, it was a big clang, and the next thing I know, I was looking up at stars because the tent was gone.
So did it blow you guys out of your bunks, or
it wounded everybody in the tent, and it there was two KIAs, Petty Officer Hubbard, who showed us around the first day, and then next to us was a hooch.
A hooch is a wooden structure.
Yeah, with screens and
a metal roof.
Yeah, and Chief Barnes was coming out of the hooch when the rocket went off, and it killed him instantly. So, but Bill, didn't you find out, or you told me that at the same time that was kind of a feint, and they wiped out some Marines on another hill?
Yeah, it was Hill 950.
So that's, I think
that was kind of a diversion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were keeping us busy while they did that. And I think that was kind of the start of planting Tet, because it wasn't too long after that it got really hot up there.
I guess they were
testing the defenses.
Yeah, I think they were trying to get a Dien Bien Phu out of Quezon.
Mm-hmm.
Only it didn't work. But
for many people out there may not be familiar with Dien Bien Phu. That's where back in 1954, the French were overrun by the then Viet Minh, I think is what they were called at the time. And again, it was a similar base that was had mountains around them. And if they weren't able to keep that kind of the beginning of the end there. And I can agree with the idea, as you were mentioning there, that you thought this was kind of this feinting or fenting move to distract attention from what was going on. I was not there during the Tet of 68. I was there at Tet of 69, which was nothing in comparison. But I see the phone is ringing. Derek, could you check the phone? Okay. But the idea is that they would throw these rockets in periodically where we were stationed just to see, I guess, how we would react is the way that I'm thinking. And
I believe one of the rockets that came in did not go off, but it was in the CP bunker hallway where the command post was. Okay. So they must have known something about the base.
Well, was Quezon like all the other bases where they had civilian employees on them?
They had mama-sans come in and do laundry. So it's possible, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Bill, what once you were woken up after getting hit with the shrapnel, what did you guys do then?
Well, we started to head for the bunker. And the first thing we had to do was we had to take care of Phil. Phil got hit real bad with shrapnel. Mm-hmm. And we had to do a little first aid on him, stop the bleeding, and then drag him down into the bunker where we bandaged him up.
Who's on the phone?
Got him ready for his medevac.
Okay, thanks. You described that this bunker was kind of built underground and it kind of served multi-purposes.
Well, the Seabees kind of have a habit of building their underground bunkers with a little bar in it. So, it was a fairly good sized bunker. We get together in there sometimes. And all the wounded from the tent and from the hooch were taken down there. There was a kid with a shrapnel in his armpit. I had a kid with a broken leg. And I think there was a corpsman there. And so he was working on the worst ones. And we were, spent time getting the wounded down into the bunker. It was packed. Mm-hmm. I mean, there must have been 20 guys in there, 24 guys.
Now, how long did this go on?
We were in there quite a long time, weren't we, Bill?
Yeah.
It was
a couple hours, I guess.
Yeah. And we did the Seabees did build an underground hospital there, which had an operating room and everything, mm-hmm. but we couldn't get them to it because of the rockets coming in.
So did this attack last a couple of hours? I mean, were they continually firing them in, or you just...
They were coming in. We couldn't tell because we were underground, but you're always wondering, well, what's coming after the rocket attack?
Yeah.
And seeing as we didn't have time to bring any weapons with us, we were busy with the wounded, and it took me with a flashlight like 10, 15 minutes to get enough first aid kits together to bring down there, too. So it was hectic, and so we didn't know really what was going on the outside.
So you mentioned that both of you guys were wounded. Did you get sent? You didn't get sent home for this. Did they just patch you up and you went back to work, or what happened?
We were the least, Bill, weren't we?
Yeah, we were the least walking wounded.
Yeah, Phil went to the ship, and then they worked on him, and he came back to the battalion, and he was on light duty until he was better. But
he went to the hospital in Japan.
He went to Japan? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought he went to the ship. But, eventually he came back to the battalion. Now, the other battalions, we don't know. I mean, there was two battalions up there, MCB 11 and MCB 4.
Okay. So, we've got a caller on a line, so I'm going to pull him up, and it's John. John? He hung up. Okay, well, we're not having good luck with that. Who's the other guy?
Wade.
Okay, Wade, you're on the line. Wade, welcome to Veterans Radio. What's your question?
Well, my question is, I know the Seabees, didn't you have to do some type of, military rifle training and stuff with the Marines before you went over there? I wanted to go to Seabees in 74 when I enlisted in the Navy, but they said they were mustering everybody out, and that kind of broke my heart, so I ended up down in the engine room on a destroyer. But didn't you guys have to do some, like, you know, military training with rifles and stuff like that? Because I know you're the fighting CBs.
Bill, I'll ask you first.
We're training at Camp Pendleton with the Marine Corps.
Oh, so you...
One of those weeks was rifle range.
Okay.
We qualified with the M14.
Did you? And what kind of weapons did you carry when you were in Vietnam?
We always carried a rifle.
And
some had 45s, but most of us had the M14 rifle.
And just like any other squad, there was a M60, M79 grenade launcher. We had all of them, but the basic was the M14, our first tour.
Okay.
And the second tour, we got the M16s.
Okay. To answer your question, Wade?
Yes, sir. Well, and God bless you guys, and thank you for your service to our country.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
Wow. Okay. All right. I must have known he was on the phone, because I was going to ask, what do you guys carry around with you? So obviously, since I'm talking to you, it's great that you both survived. But you still had a long time to go in your tour. So when you came back to Da Nang, what are the kind of jobs did you do? Bill, what was the most memorable job that you did while you were there? Either tour.
Well, we were at Camp Hoover, and that was right next to the what they call the in-country R&R Recreation Center at Hill 327. It was they called it the Big PX.
Yeah.
Okay.
Also Freedom Hill, I think it was.
Freedom Hill. And we built various structures there. There was a movie theater, which our battalion had to finish or complete. Another battalion had started it, and we had to finish it. And we were doing the air conditioning. One of the few buildings that was air conditioned.
I was going to say, where was that? It's the Navy.
It was right next to the outdoor amphitheater, where they always have the Christmas shows.
Oh, okay. Did you guys, either one of you, get to see the Christmas shows?
We built them, but we didn't see them.
We didn't see any. We didn't hit it right.
Oh. Yeah, I didn't get to see it either. It was my first week in country, and I was the newest pilot, so I had to fly that day, and we flew close to the Bob Hope show. So I can say I saw it from about 3,000 feet, but yeah. I didn't hear anything. So you had to, that reminds me of another question. Did you guys build facilities for the other services, or like the Army and so forth?
Yeah, we sure did. Didn't matter.
The MP bases we built, that was our second tour when we were at China Beach, across the street. And also, Bill and I, in the second tour, we didn't work together. We weren't in the same squad. I was sent up north to Quang Tri, where we laid a pipeline from Utah Beach. It was 18 miles of JP-4 fuel line to Quang Tri Air Base.
Okay, you mentioned this. Now, this was not a buried pipeline.
No, well, some of it was and some of it
wasn't. That was my job. I came on later, and they decided to bury it because it was
getting blown up every day.
Destroyed every night with hand grenades.
Yeah, they were setting booby traps on it. Every morning we'd get out there, it'd be booby trap. But before Bill got out there, I was... Someone had the great idea because we had to cross a bridge, and you couldn't do it during the daytime because of the convoys, because
right.
we had to hang the pipe on the side of the bridge. So we had to do it in the middle of the night under floodlights. And there was supposed to be
another example of military genius.
I think they would call that brilliant.
Yeah, there was supposed to be an Arvin company that was supposed to meet us there and protect us. And there was 12 of us when we got there, and that's all that was there. There was never an Arvin company. So we put our flak jackets on and hung off the side of the bridge and put the pipe up under floodlights. And
were you disturbed at all while you were doing that?
We were nervous.
Nobody bothered you?
Luckily, no one bothered us. You know, we're waiting for pings off the side of the bridge. But we got done about 2 in the morning, and we didn't want to stick around, so we were going to drive back to Quang Tri Air Base. And so you've got a backhoe with a front end loader, a 6x and a deuce and a half, and you're driving down the dark road at 2 o'clock in the morning.
That's not good anywhere.
With no lights.
This was during Tet, remember?
Yeah. So we got about a mile from the airbase, and we're trying to figure out how we're going to get back on the base because they'll shoot anybody coming by the base. And we see rockets going into the base, so we pulled off into the jungle and stayed there the rest of the night. But it was a fun night. Thanks.
Well, Bill, you mentioned there that you guys were there during Tet of 68. You were coming back for your second time around?
Yeah,
that was our second time.
We got called up early, Bill. Remember?
Yeah, that's right.
We have another month, I think, left in the States, and I got a phone call.
No, we weren't supposed to go back until April.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so, yeah, we weren't there for the night of Tet, but we were there for the Tet, yeah. And
it was still during the Tet period.
Yeah, yeah. It was pretty bad up near Quang Tri because their houses were all completely leveled and everything. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of fighting up in that area, too. Bill, did you ever get any place like in Wei or anything like that?
We drove past it on Highway 1
yeah.
when we were going up for the pipeline.
Yeah, so...
So you guys were pretty much confined to I Corps.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, the Gulfport, Mississippi CBs were in the south. Mm-hmm. They split up between Gulfport, Mississippi, and Port Hueneme, California, were the two bases.
Okay.
And so half the battalions were in each one of them. So the Port Hueneme CBs were in I Corps mostly.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that because when I got to Vietnam, we already had some barracks that had already been built, mostly Hoochers, one-level Hooch, and a lot of tents. And I went up north for 3 or 4 weeks on a mission, came back, and we had all these finished buildings. And it was like, wow, these are cool. And, made it somewhat comfortable, but compared to a lot of people that we know that slept out in the field the whole year that they were there. I can't imagine doing that. We got about 5 or 6 minutes to go here. Larry, you always, there's a picture that you always show. Larry and I have done a number of high school presentations together, and you had a visitor one night. I'm thinking, was it one night in your
Yeah, it was in Quang Tri at the air base. It was like 2 in the morning, and the sirens started going off, and of course the air base gets hit a lot up there, and the rockets started coming in, so we ran out of our tent. And I was about the third guy in line heading for the underground bunker, and it was a narrow bunker. It wasn't a large bunker. It was just narrow. And I made it to the top of the steps, and the first two guys come running out and ran right over the top of me yelling, snake. And there was an 8-foot boa constrictor or whatever it was down there. And so we hugged up against the side of the sandbags for the rest of the night. And
Nobody was going in there.
No one's going in there. No. It was already taken.
Isn't it amazing how we're so afraid of those little animals, creatures?
Yeah.
Of the night, I had my own little running with a snake, too. And it was, I don't like snakes. So Bill, you went up and finished the pipeline that Larry had been working on. What other kind of projects did you work on while you were in country?
We did hospitals.
Were these strictly military hospitals? Or did
military,
you...
yeah, Marine Corps.
Okay.
Yeah. We did do a few civilian projects, though.
Yeah.
We did a school in Da Nang.
A lot of infrastructure done
after
the schools and churches and things like that. I worked at the hospitals, too. We were building some operating rooms and things like that as in the Marine I Corps there. So, yeah.
I want to do this transition in the last couple of minutes, though, of your building schools and other civilian things to help out the local populations, because I know that as Vietnam ended and as our caller mentioned, he couldn't get into the CBs because of what do they call it now? Anyway.
We were decommissioning battalions.
Rolling down and getting everybody out because they didn't need everybody any longer.
Yeah.
And, then we kind of go over a 20-year time period, and then suddenly they need CBs again. And I'll ask either one of you if you want to address what you know about what was occurring in Iraq and Afghanistan.
At the end of the Vietnam War, they decommissioned all but six of the battalions. And ours was one of the ones they kept.
So that's 6,000.
That's 6,000. Okay. And one of them was amphibious, was a battalion. And then there's about 4,000 reservists, CB mm-hmm. reservists. So basically, I mean, after most of the peacetime, the CBs are all over the world building. In Japan, when they had that tsunami,
yeah,
they were in there and building earthquakes and stuff like that. But they were in all the major battles in Iraq and Afghanistan, Iraqi freedom, all the mm-hmm. enduring freedom. And there's probably about 10,000 CBs that are active doing that because they did call up the reserves for that.
Okay.
So,
and doing the same thing.
Basically, you know, the same thing. They do a lot of civic action, the CBs. They go from village to village with doctors, with the corpsmen and the doctors, mm-hmm. and building wells and, you know, improving the living structure of the village, of the people in the village. Mm-hmm. So it does bring up the, help build up the countries that we go into.
Right. Yeah, I know it's a difficult question. You know, when you say, you know, what did you do while you were there? And again, many of the guests that we've had on Veterans Radio have talked about that there's been a squad of CBs with them when they go into a village sometimes because they'll rebuild their water supply system or they'll set up sanitation or they'll build or repair a school or a building or something yeah. along those lines. So it sounds like a great history and. We got a couple of minutes here, so I'm going to ask Larry, so what's coming up next year?
Well, next year is the 75th anniversary of the CBs. It's called the Diamond Anniversary, and there will be two places where they have the big reunions at Port Hueneme, California, and then the East Coast CBs have one locally at Hampton, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I saw Bill in 2010 after 42 years of not seeing him. We finally got together. Him and Phil were probably the best friends I've ever had in my life.
And it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
We all get older, but you don't forget your friends.
No, you don't. I think one of the problems that probably we all run into is that we have, you know, we're whatever our age is, we still got a 20-year-old brain stuck in our head, and we remember all of the incredible people that we met and that we lost. But had such an influence on our lives.
Yeah, and I want to say any MCB4 members, whatever era, we're having our reunion this year on the 15th of September in Washington, D.C. And so if you go online and look up MCB4.
MCB4.
2016 reunion.
Okay, go. Everybody, go to that. So are you guys going to hook up there?
Yeah.
All right. Well, Bill, I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio today and sharing these stories with us. I think it's important that we keep them going.
You're welcome.
And Larry, thank you very much again. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And thank you for sharing what you did. You know, when the question comes, what did you do in the war, Dad? You can say, well, this is what I did. And we want to thank you. It's always interesting to find out about these organizations that many of us are not familiar with. And so we want to thank these two gentlemen for being on our program and congratulate the CBs for the 75th anniversary coming up next year. And I want to thank you all for listening to Veterans Radio today. Tune in next week. Bob Gould is going to be your host. And until then, if I can't think of anything else, check us on Facebook, check our archives. Anything else you want, send us an email. We'll get back in touch with you. Until next week, you are dismissed. Thank you.